just makes no sense to me to be copying all this stuff and shipping 6 boxes around the state of Alaska.
A state lawmaker asked the governor's office to make the Palin emails more accessible. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 7th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the British ambassador visits Alaska.
We are the number one world importer of canned salmon, because that's regarded still as a great delicacy in the UK.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
When the state releases more than 24,000 pages of former Governor Sarah Palin's emails on Friday, some legislators plan to make copies available to the public. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Governor Sean Parnell's office will provide one public review copy of the emails in Juneau, which an Anchorage Daily News editorial on Sunday called a good argument for moving the Capitol. That prompted Juneau Democratic State Senator Dennis Egan to offer to pay for copies to be placed at the governor's offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
We should expect government to get public information out in an effective manner and to have it timely, especially in this day and age, in the electronic age. It just makes no sense to me to be copying all this stuff and shipping 6 boxes around the state of Alaska.
Parnell's chief of staff, Mike Nizek, declined Egan's offer, according to the governor's spokeswoman, Sharon Lehow. But she says Egan will get a copy, and Anchorage Democratic Representatives Berta Gardner and Mike Dugan will get one to share free of charge. What they do with them is their business. Gardner says the legislators will make their copy available to the public at the Anchorage Legislative Information Office.
Anybody who wants to see them, I think they're state business, and that's a matter of public record, and good government requires that such information be publicly available.
Several news organizations and activists requested the emails during Palin's vice presidential campaign in 2008. The state will charge each organization or individual $725 plus shipping for the hard copies. Lehow says the governor's office doesn't have the technology to make the emails available electronically, despite the fact that most modern copiers allow documents to be scanned into PDF files.
We don't have software that can deliver the records electronically. We are looking into that.
Egan calls that bogus.
Come on, my office can do that.
MSNBC, one of the news organizations that requested the emails, plans to make them available online. The records cover most of Palin's tenure as governor, from the time she took office through her selection as Republican vice presidential candidate in September 2008. Some information will be redacted for reasons including executive and attorney-client privilege. Palin resigned in July 2009, and Parnell, her lieutenant governor, was elevated to the governor's office. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
British Ambassador Sir Nigel Sheinwald is visiting Alaska for the first time, and he has a lot on his plate. A remarkable number of Alaska issues involve British corporations, BP and Anglo-American, for instance. The veteran diplomat says there was no one particular issue that drew him to the state. He just wanted to see things for himself. He spent a few minutes yesterday speaking with APRN's Steve Heimel.
Sir Nigel is what you could call a mover and a shaker. He was Prime Minister Tony Blair's foreign policy advisor during those stormy years after Blair and U.S. President George W. Bush formed a coalition of the willing to invade Iraq. He took over the ambassador's post under Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, and now continues under David Cameron. It's quite apparent that he's here on behalf of the United Kingdom's commercial interests.
British companies are the biggest employers, the biggest foreign employers in the United States. Nearly 1 million American jobs are in British-owned companies. About the same number of British jobs are in American-owned companies. There's a huge amount of economic interdependence.
And what if this interdependence involves Alaska? Well, for one thing,
we are the number one world importer of canned salmon, because that's regarded still as a great delicacy in the UK. So if you're an Alaskan and you're a lover of canned salmon, Britain is the place to visit internationally if you want to feel at home.
So add tourism to the mix, and then you get down to the hard industries like mining. Anglo American is a British company that's bought its way into the pebble mining prospect. Scheinwald is well aware of the controversy about pebble, of course. He sent Alaska newspapers an op-ed talking about how the UK expects its companies to observe the strictest environmental standards. And Monday, he took the trip himself to the remote headwaters north of Lake Iliamna.
I'd heard about this project some time ago, met with the chief executive and a number of other people over the last 18 months, 2 years or so, but thought it was very important on my first visit to Alaska to have a chance to look at the situation on the ground for myself. But I think the key thing I come away from is that the company knows that it has to make the case. It has to make it on the basis of good science, sustainability, working with the local people, working with those whose livelihoods depend on this particular part of Alaska, and that it will be a properly thought through and properly regulated process. And that, I think, is what they're asking for. And as the ambassador of the country concerned, that's what I'm asking for. I'm asking for a decent and due process and a chance for their case to be heard.
The ambassador met on the same day with the United Fishermen of Alaska. He said he wanted to be sure he understood their worries about what the mine could potentially do to the world's biggest wild sockeye salmon run. Thursday, he will concern himself with another British corporation, taking a trip to Prudhoe Bay with BP. The company has been trying to show it has learned from its spills in both Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. Scheinwald points out that the amount BP has paid out in the Gulf already exceeds the $6 billion punitive damage award an Alaska jury initially slammed onto Exxon for its spill in Alaska. He says BP has been taking responsibility.
This has still got some way to run. I mean, investigations are still continuing. But apart from that, the environmental damage, on the surface anyway, looks to have been contained. And a very substantial sum has been set aside for financial compensation. And I think they've spent already about $8 billion in compensation to individuals who've been affected. But BP are very clear that they have a long way to go to restore their reputation in this matter. But they're going about it, I think, again, in a responsible and long-sighted way.
Ambassador Scheinwald said he did not know enough yet to comment on whether, as a natural gas producer, BP was doing enough to get it to market through an Alaska pipeline. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Department of Defense has released the names of the four Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson soldiers killed by a roadside bomb Saturday in Afghanistan. Sergeant Joshua David Powell was a 28-year-old from Texas. He joined the Army in 2004. Corporal Christopher Roger Bell was a 21-year-old from Mississippi. Specialist Devin Ariel Snyder was a 20-year-old from New York. And Private First Class Robert Lee Vokes Jr. was a 21-year-old from Michigan. Officials say the four military policemen were killed while on mounted patrol in Langman Province. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, solving a biological puzzle at a unique kittiwake colony on a remote Alaskan island.
Come to look at it in Alaska and found that kittiwakes had abject breeding failure. I mean, zero young produced in many colonies for many years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
The Denali Rescue Helicopter was busy last night taking care of patients high on Mount McKinley in three separate incidents. One climbing patrol had to deal with several mountaineers suffering from severe high-altitude sickness. Tucker Chenoweth and four other patrol volunteers were descending from the summit of Denali when they encountered a solo climber suffering from altitude issues. A 27-year-old Serbian climber staggered in front of them and collapsed. After doing an exam, the five rescuers decided that there wasn't any way the climber could descend without further help. The rescue helicopter was able to fly up to 19,300 feet and safely get him lower on the mountain. Park spokeswoman Maureen McLaughlin says then the patrol members encountered another climber.
While that was all transpiring, another solo traveler was moving down the mountain who was also having altitude-related problems, and then came upon Tucker and his group, and similarly also was compromised, you know, was suffering from altitude and collapsed in front of them.
The rescue helicopter returned and short-hauled the second patient to the 14,000-foot camp. Chenoweth and his volunteers continued their descent only to come across yet another climber.
He was, you know, semi-conscious and also couldn't come down on his own. So the third rescue took place, and it all fell through smoothly. Everyone, you know, got descended down, and all three are doing fine today.
The Serbian climber refused treatment after feeling much better at lower elevation. The other two were transported to an aerial hospital via LifeMed air ambulance. McLaughlin says the Ranger Patrol finally made it safely to the high camp at 17,000 feet without further incident and have the day off today. Two women reported being attacked by bald eagles Monday morning in separate attacks less than 2 hours apart at the Dutch Harbor Post Office. KUCB's Jacob Resnick has more.
Both women were struck by the eagles nesting near the Dutch Harbor Post Office. Bald eagles are nesting this time of year and very sensitive to humans. Wildlife Trooper Sergeant Robin Morissette says his office fielded calls following the incidents.
And it sounded like there had been a couple of people that were at the post office on the Dutch Harbor side that had been attacked by the eagles. And I believe one of the people went up to the hospital, and I don't know who they were. I just know that a couple of individuals were attacked, and that people need to be aware that this is the time when eagles do sit on nests. So they're at the post office, I guess, on the Dutch Harbor side and the Unalaska side where it's happened before.
It's not the first time eagles have struck people in the community. Last July, there was a spate of attacks by nesting eagles. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesman Bruce Woods in Anchorage says federal biologists visited Unalaska last summer to try and find solutions.
The service had some people out there last year when I think someone had been dive-bombed and had attempted to work with the community to, you know, I think put up some signage and figure out ways to route foot traffic differently so that at least while the eagles are in defensive mode when they're in the middle of raising their young to sort of move traffic patterns a little bit further away.
Because of federal protections on eagles, there are few legal ways to move nesting birds. Wood says his agency's advice is for people to be extra aware where eagles are nesting.
Most cases, they're not going to actually strike. Most cases, all they want you to do is move a little further away. And if you see eagles and they're beginning to act disturbed, the best thing to do is just not bolt, but just move a little further away from them.
The Unalaska Department of Public Safety says it's been posting signs in known trouble spots. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Picture a giant chicken coop in the middle of a treeless island in the Gulf of Alaska. But the coop is really an old concrete Air Force radar tower. And instead of chickens, it holds black-legged kittiwakes. With a few tweaks, this dilapidated building has become one of the best outdoor bird observation platforms in the world. Federal biologist Scott Hatch has spent the last 15 years taking advantage of it, and he's uncovered a fascinating puzzle that could offer clues into the aging process. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
In 1986, a few kittiwakes started breeding on the old Air Force Tower on Middleton. United States Geological Survey biologist Scott Hatch saw possibility.
Looking at the building, I mean, this is a, you know, kind of a
cool situation where the birds are nesting on a building that you can go inside and potentially could be looking from the inside out at the birds.
Hatch removed literally tons of metal and other material from the building to make it a more inviting breeding site. Then he installed one-way mirrored glass so he can see out, but the birds can't see in. It's like a giant bird hotel with nearly 600 kittiwake suites. Inside the tower, it's noisy with the chatter of so many birds. Hatch took an audio recorder along for his first trip to Middleton this year in April.
These windows are really pretty remarkable. You can get to within inches of the birds you're observing. I like to tell people, sort of tongue-in-cheek, you can literally do schmush faces on the window. My face is probably 8 inches or so from the bird. And so you get a real up-close and personal look at bird behavior on this tower.
When Hatch first started going to Middleton in the 1970s, the island was home to one of the largest kittiwake populations in the world. More than 150,000 birds nested on the island. Now the population is one-tenth of that, and Hatch says one curious fact about these kittiwakes is that they are terrible breeders. And by terrible, I mean really, really terrible.
Come to look at it in Alaska and found that kittiwakes had abject breeding failure. I mean, zero young produced in many colonies for many years. And Middleton Island was maybe the best, you know, example of that.
That dismal breeding record has continued for decades, but a researcher studying black-legged kittiwake several decades ago in England found just the opposite. Those North Atlantic birds were producing at least one chick per breeding pair per year, and they had short lifespans, living about 10 years. Hatch realized the Alaskan kittiwakes were probably living longer.
And so I hypothesized reasonably enough that they must have very high survival as, you know, to compensate, otherwise we should have been out of kittiwakes a long time ago.
It turned out to be true. The Alaskan kittiwakes live almost twice as long as their North Atlantic counterparts, about 20 years. Genetically, these birds are nearly identical, but they have very different lifespans. Much of Hatch's research since has been devoted to figuring out why the Alaskan birds are so different. Every summer, a team of international volunteers camps out in the island to study them. During the April visit, Hatch put GPS bands on several birds so he could track where they were feeding in the ocean.
All right, she looks pretty happy.
Yeah, we cut off these things.
Now you go do some nice feeding.
Ow!
Okay. Hatch thinks the birds' trouble raising young has to do with their diet, so he wants to know where they're getting their food and what they're eating.
Okay, goodbye. And now let's look for our next victim.
He also wants to know if feeding the kittiwakes makes a difference. So 15 years ago, he began offering fish to a group of the birds. It's an all-you-can-eat kind of arrangement. And this spring, the birds had healthy appetites.
Well, the bird in A24 has just eaten 7 fish. So that's, you know, 150 grams or more. That's not a record. I think the record was 9 fish at one meal, and a daily record, I believe, was 16 or 19 fish, something like that. Bird probably ate easily its body weight in one day.
About 70 of the kittiwake pairs on the tower get this extra food. It's capelin, a small fish they find naturally in the ocean. Hatch says even though they can have as much as they want, the birds just use the free food as a supplement to their regular diet. That surprised him.
I expected we'd create a bunch of lazy kittiwakes that would essentially be completely on the dole year after year once they learned the drill, that we're going to feed them whatever food they want except at the nest, that they would become completely dependent on that and just sit around, not even bother to fly out. I'm being slightly facetious here, but only slightly. I mean, why, as a breeding animal, would you go to the trouble to go out in the ocean and fish at a lot of, you know, expense energetically and possibly risking your own life when you can just sit around on the ledge at the tower and 3 times a day you're going to get all the food you can eat?
Hatch wondered if these well-fed kittiwakes would start to act more like North Atlantic kittiwakes. Would they raise more young? And after that, would their lifespan decrease? We'll have those answers in part 2 of the story tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see a slideshow of the impressive kittiwake tower on Middleton Island and the work that goes on there, visit our new website, alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is being proactive in anticipation of another weak king salmon return to the Yukon River. No angling will be allowed for king salmon on the main stem of the Yukon. On Yukon tributaries, except the Tanana, the bag limit for kings is dropping from 3 fish to 1. Yukon River sport fish biologist John Burr says the measures are precautionary.
We've had poor runs in the last few years. We've failed to meet border escapement into Canada 3 of the last 4 years. And so this is we have to assume that things will be no better than they were last year. And so we're trying to make sure that we get that border escapement goal attained.
Burr says sports fishing only accounts for a very small portion of salmon harvest. Other harvest reductions include elimination of commercial fishing and closure of one of the early subsistence openings. Burr says the tactics are part of a new package of measures aimed at allowing more kings upriver.
Last year, we didn't pull any of the subsistence periods early in the run. And there were some king salmon that were sold in the commercial fishery for summer chum salmon. It wasn't a directed king salmon fishery, but some of those fish were sold. This year, the current plan is to not permit the sale of king salmon caught in other fisheries.
King salmon normally begin entering the Yukon River at the beginning of June, with the bulk of the early part of the run headed for Canada.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Alaska Redistricting Board has approved new political boundaries. Executive Director Taylor Bickford says there's still a few minor details to iron out, but under the plan, the Mat-Su will gain a House seat and Southeast Alaska will lose a House seat and half a Senate seat. Bickford says the plan gives the Mat-Su 5 House seats based on an ideal population number for each House district.
They had 4 House districts in the previous cycle, and this is really just a numbers-driven process. You divide the state population by 40. That gives you an ideal district size of 17,755. Mat-Su Borough has enough population for 5. And so that wasn't really a decision that was made by the board. I think that all the outside plans, if they didn't have 5 districts that were purely within the Mat-Su, they had 4 districts and then 2 that were split. But the bottom line is the population is there in the Mat-Su for 5.
Bickford says bits and pieces of alternative plans submitted to the board were woven into the final draft. The board will meet again next week before finalizing the draft on June 14th. The plan for Southeast makes major changes to answer community concerns, but the result pits 2 pairs of sitting lawmakers against each other, which is raising new worries. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Alaska Redistricting Board's latest proposed boundaries combine Wrangell and Ketchikan into one House district. That sets up a likely Republican 2012 primary fight between incumbent Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson and his colleague, Peggy Wilson of Wrangell.
I feel bad that Kyle and I are going to be up against each other. That's something that I'm sad about. But for me, it could have been a much bigger, huge district, and it will be much easier to get around than it could have been.
Wrangell has spent the past decade in a House district with Petersburg and Sitka. The new district with Ketchikan also includes Saxman, Thorne Bay, and Northern Prince of Wales Island. Johansson says he's ready to face voters within the new boundaries.
I'm looking forward to running again, and if Peggy decides that she's going to run, I know that we'll have a healthy and issues-oriented campaign.
Before that, he faces a recall effort from Ketchikan Republicans over his departure from the House Majority Caucus. The other Southeast legislative face-off would be for the Senate seat, including the Ketchikan-Wrangell House District. Its companion House District would include Sitka and Angoon, as well as Craig, Metlakatla, Haines, Hoonah, and some other towns. That could pit Sitka Republican Bert Stedman against Angoon Democrat Albert Kukesh. Neither could be reached for immediate comment. Haines Republican Bill Thomas, who represents the smaller communities in the district, says it could be a competitive race.
I haven't looked at the breakdown of party affiliation. You know,
the independents is the one to make the elections happen anyway. So it'll be the person that sells themselves like all elections.
Thomas, meanwhile, could face a serious challenge himself. His district loses Gustavus, Skagway, Tenneke, Yakutat, and Cordova under the latest plan. He gains Sitka, which could become the district's largest community and could field a strong hometown challenger.
Well, I think I got my work laid out for me, so I don't know. We'll go look forward and see what the final plan happens or does there, but disappointed in losing some of my district.
Juneau's three incumbent legislators retain most of their electoral base under the plan. Thomas says smaller communities added to Juneau districts could be dwarfed by the population difference. Juneau's incumbents have said they'll do their best to represent smaller communities. Earlier versions of the redistricting plan matched two Southeast House districts with communities outside the region to form Senate districts. The latest version creates two Southeast-only seats. That guarantees both will be held by Panhandle residents, but it means the region loses the potential to have a third senator, as it does now. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Fairbanks City Council has voted to stop adding fluoride to the municipal water system. The move follows a lengthy investigation by a council-appointed task force of experts. The report released this spring recommended no additional fluoride be added because local groundwater already contains some natural fluoride. It also cites studies which shows ingestion of higher levels of fluoride to be unsafe for non-nursing infants. Fluoride has also been linked to health problems, including weakening of bones, but it's credited with reducing tooth decay over several decades. Mayor Jerry Cleworth says the council's decision is in line with many other governments.
It is pretty much in conjunction with what we have seen going on in Europe and many other parts of the United States right now, which tends to be a general movement at rethinking the whole fluoridation issue. And most municipalities seem to be taking it out.
Fluoridation of drinking water is still recommended by the American Dental Association and health agencies. The Fairbanks ordinance takes effect July 1st. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.